closer.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I am your lovely host. Oh, my goodness. It's happening again. You probably didn't think it would happen again, but it's happening again. Today is a cool, groovy, sweet day on the awesome day on the I'm going to try to use the word awesome more often. These are the things I think about. I create these little goals. I'm very completion focused, so that's never been my problem. And I create these little goals, and then I go out to the world and try to meet them. And my goal is to use the word awesome more. I don't know why. For 1 year, I tried to use the word touche every day. That was kind of a cool year. But this year, I'm trying to use awesome. So today's podcast is great. This may be one of the more interesting podcasts I've done in a long time. It's a long one. So if you don't want to sit through the whole thing, you always have my permission not to. Never worry about that. But I kind of think you will. This is crazy today. This is my buddy. This is Dr. Casey Chosewood, and he is the medical director for the CDC. He's had really cool titles before that. Before that, he was the, I can't remember, I'll craft up what I think it is and get close. I think he was like the senior medical officer in the Office of Strategy and Innovation at the CDC, which is very cool. You know, I have this friend, Roland Poole, who for a long time worked at the Smithsonian in volcanoes, and I always thought that was a cool job to have. And you'd call Roland, and somebody would say volcanoes, and then then forward you to him. This is a really good podcast because Casey's one of my buds. I kind of have a bromance. I'm going to try not to gush too much, but I really like this guy a lot for a bunch of reasons. We met at Berkeley at kind of a fancy pants meeting, invitation only fancy pants. Carlene Roberts was there and Ed Schein was there, and it was a who's who kind of meeting. And Casey and I sat at the kids' table, so as you can imagine, there was clearly there was a pecking order of the tables for sure, there was this table in the back, and there was this guy sitting there, and I sat there, and this guy's hilarious. He's so funny and you know, clever and interesting, and had all sorts of lots of retorts. Can you tell that they're sawing something across the street? Can you hear that on the microphone? I bet you can. Well, we can talk about that later. Anyway, we started yucking up and cracking up, and I thought, I just love this guy. He's hilarious. I had no idea what he did, but he's hilarious. And then he got up and spoke. And angels sang, and the sea parted, and a rainbow appeared, and I got to hear him speak. And so I got a chance to actually, we were speaking again at another meeting, this time in D.C. I got a chance for my friend Scott to cut some direct feed off the soundboard. If you're a deadhead, that was a very meaningful thing I just said right there. And I got the audio from a meeting he did, checked it with Casey. He said no problem. And in fact, I'm going to get Casey on the podcast. He's busy and I'm busy, and this is kind of the next best thing. So let me quit gushing. I need to shut up because this podcast is kind of long. Sit back and listen. I hope you're doing good. It's weird here. This is clearly the winter that forgot to come to New Mexico. So it's like we had fall for a really long time, and then we had spring. Is kind of what it looks like happened, at least on my side of the tracks. But everything's okay, and it's good. And if there's anything I can help you with, anything you need on the podcast, give me a ring. But until then, let me shut up. I said I would. Here's Casey Chosewood from the CDC. This is on worker safety, health, and the work environment.
As many of you know, the challenges that workers are facing today are probably more rapidly evolving than ever before. And that's why I've sort of couched the words that I will share with you today sort of in the sequence of, is it really time for a new way to work? And then I will sort of hedge my bets and say maybe not. Because the way that we are defining work today, dramatically different than a generation ago. One of the quotes that I'm just blows me away is, and you'll see it later in my slides, but it's that my father had one job for 60 years. I will likely have six jobs over my lifetime. My son, who's 24, will likely have six jobs at one time, right? So the nature of work and employment and workplace arrangements, the economic give and take between a person providing work and someone selecting to take up that work, dramatically different than ever before. We're also lulled into thinking about the future, into believing that the pace of change that we're going to experience in the next 10 years will roughly be similar to the pace of change that we have lived through the last 10 years. But it's likely that that's an exponential jump instead of just a mere reflection of the past. So likely the changes that we've experienced for a big part of our working lives over the last 10 years, you're likely to see that pace of change in the next 1 year. And if you're around for 10 years, you're going to see change that's unprecedented in the history of man. So even if you look at the chronicling of change from the time that history was recorded until today, we're likely to see a faster pace of change in the next 10 years than all of that combined. So when we talk about the way we will work or not, we have to keep that pace of change in mind. And in fact, there are predictions, and there are even experiments in Northern Europe, that a significant portion of the population will not work in the future. So they're talking about how will people who don't work spend their time? Will we convert libraries and factories into these places where people go for socialization and entertainment? Will the government guarantee some subsistence of living, but only maybe 1 in 3 people will actually work? Will this be a result of robotization, of mechanization, of all of the technology changes that we know are on the way? There may be a substantial portion of people who do not work. So these are all at the very heart of looking at this interface between work and what it means for the rest of our lives, between work and what it means for our family relationships, work and what it means for our health, our longevity, our opportunities down the road. These questions about what the future will bring, in essence, for people who have to work or who don't, are extremely important. And like OSHA, NIOSH has had a fairly flat budget, as you can imagine, for the past 8 years or so. In fact, the only real increase in the budget in NIOSH has been in the World Trade Center Health Program, which now has a 75-year funding stream. So if for no other reason, NIOSH is likely to be around for 75 years. We do have a secure funding stream to manage the World Trade Center Health Program. But otherwise, the budget for NIOSH is fairly flat. So it is extremely important for us to prioritize research, for us to look into the science of healthier, safer work, so that we can better inform OSHA, we can better inform employers and workers and their representatives. It's incumbent upon us to prioritize our investments, to think very wisely about should we invest in total worker health versus should we do more in recommended exposure limits? Should we explore this whole new science of cumulative risk, of which total worker health is a very important part, or should we fall back to look at, you know, the biological consequences of shift work in animal models, as some of our scientists do in Morgantown? So when you're trying to prioritize the issues, the challenges, the risks, the exposures that workers face, this is a very important question. And my job in Total Worker Health is really to try to frame what value we can bring to the workplace. How can the work we do, the investment that we have of taxpayer money, how can we best use that to improve the safety and health of workers? And I'm hopeful, because most of the science that I'll mention today, you're already aware of it. But what I'm hopeful is that some of what I share today will let you look at the challenges that your workers face in a different way and maybe come away with a few more tools in your toolkit to help move them to a safer, healthier place. We talk a lot about this new concept of well-being, and in fact, under John Howard's direction, we have a new cross-sector in the National Occupational Research Agenda called Healthy Work Design and Well-Being. And at the very heart of it is really this examination of the new way we work, how we are going to interact from a safety and health standpoint with the new way that people toil. Whoops. Let's make sure I get this right. Oh, I want to introduce you to someone who's perhaps the most important person in my life these days. This is my granddaughter, Lily. And I really share Lily's story with folks because it does really get to the nature of what the future is going to look like and how the decisions we're making today are absolutely going to impact her. Here's just an amazing statistic that I heard from a futurist, someone who's predicting the future. And he said, people born today have only a 1 in 3 chance of ever having a driver's license. What? 1 in 3? It's very likely by the time she's ready to drive, the majority of cars sold will be autonomously driven, right? So she may have never a reason to learn the pleasure of getting her first car and driving it. You know, she'll just push a button. Yeah, a parallel parking. She'll never have the experience of learning that, of sending her own father through the roof as he's, you know, trying to teach her how to drive. Again, getting to the pace of change that we're likely to see in a very, very short period. I mean, that's only, she's 3 years old. It's 13 years away. So pretty amazing. But I also start thinking about the reasons that our workers come to work. It isn't usually just for an income. It usually is to take advantage of other things they want to do in their lives. While work is fulfilling and work should be meaningful, and work obviously provides an income, in general, we work for other reasons, right? So if that's true, then preserving our health has got to be an important concept. It isn't really reasonable to expect people to trade the units of health they have for wages. That isn't really part of the employee-employer contract. People really should go home at the end of the day with the same level of health that they arrived. In fact, that's the really lived experience of the OSHA Act, right? Is that you go home with the same level of health that you came in that morning. But we will make the argument today that that's not enough. See, the best employers do more than that. They send their workers home with more health at the end of the day. That's really the promise of a total worker health approach, of a cumulative risk and cumulative assessment, cumulative set of interventions approach, is that work in and of itself can create positive outcomes. Now, is that always going to be possible? Clearly, there are many, many companies, many organizations who fall short of that promise. But that really is, if we had an end dream state, that would be it, that every worker goes home at the end of the day with more health than he or she arrived with that morning. Now, that sounds great for the worker, for their families, for their ability to stay on the job, for their workability over a lifetime, for their avoidance of job lock, where I have to stay in a job because I don't have opportunities to leave. But here's the secret to that. You see, those same workers that went home at the end of the day with more health, they wake up the next morning and they bring a higher level of health with them back to the job. And for the employer, that translates into decreased injury and illness rates, decreased spending on health care, less likely to disengage and to be disruptive in the workplace, more likely to be more productive, more likely to contribute to the bottom line of that company. So for us, we see this as really a win-win for both worker and employer, and really more broadly society as a whole. So what job is Lily likely to have and which one is she not? Well, she's not likely to be a long-haul truck driver because deliveries and the way that we deliver and automate today is going to decrease the demand for that in a huge way. In fact, semi-autonomous trucks are already on the road. The state of Nevada allows that. They're already in wide use in some areas. There are a number of pilots underway in many cities where Uber cars are pretty much self-driving. They just have a human there just to make sure everything's going okay. So we're already seeing these changes happening. We know that she's not likely to be a toll taker at a toll road, right? Those are all automated now. There are tons of jobs that are disappearing, and yet demand for new jobs coming about. really the basis of change and the pace of change is really why we have to take another look at the way we work. It's no surprise to you that work and health are extremely connected. And we're going to talk about some of these ways today in more detail. But I wanted just to give you sort of an overall list that you can refer back to as you're trying to make the case that work and health of our workforce is extremely connected. And on this next slide, I really love this concept of time poverty that I would like to tell you a little bit more about. So in this sort of new economy where people are piecing together a number of gigs or jobs in order to make a living, there is this move toward really having no time left over for the other pursuits of health, no time left over for physical activity, no time left over to shop for healthier foods or prepare foods, no time left over to interact with family, to take care of kids, to grow relationships. That time poverty is a very real experience, a really lived experience for a growing segment of our workforce. Also, work is really where we get so many of the benefits that we enjoy, that add quality, that add depth to our life. Work for many people is a very social place. It's where we interact with people. It's where we have relationships. It's where we talk about the football game. But being from Atlanta, we will not talk about the football game, okay? For heaven's sakes, I was happy to leave town. It was just like a cloud of depression over the whole city. So please, if I'm a little off my game, you'll know why. Basically, work is central to people's well-being, and I think we've made that point. Decent work sums up the aspirations of people in their working lives. I love that quote from the International Labor Organization that really looks at this concept of decent work, and it's highly individualized. What it is for one person is going to be different from someone else. Extremely important concept. We talked about how change is going to happen at a more rapid pace than ever before, but I want you to take a look at this sort of VUCA characteristics of the 21st century. There will be uncertainty, and that may be something that we have to be comfortable living with. There is complexity, and there's going to be this sense of unknown, of ambiguity, and we have to look at the decisions we make around work and health with these things in mind. Here's the quote I mentioned before, but it's more than just sort of this kind of eye-opening, hit-you-in-the-face concept. Take a look at what's related to that, this concept of job insecurity. If you were not certain that you would have a job in 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 6 weeks, how comfortable would that feel? How much worry or stress would that bring to your existence? Most people feel pretty confident, I would think, in this room that a month from now, 6 months from now, you'll have an income if you want it. People in the gig economy do not have that level of assurance, that level of job security. That in and of itself, the very economic arrangement of work has multiplied their work-associated stress, their life-associated pressure. It also obviously changes advancement opportunities. No company is going to invest in a temporary worker, a gig worker, a part-time worker, grow that skill set over time because that person will be gone in a number of weeks. Oftentimes benefits, if they do exist, are far diminished. And certainly these jobs tend not to have any representation level as well. Another fascinating fact that to put in your mix, average number of jobs in a lifetime, and my guess is many of you have far fewer than this, but this is data through 2015, so it's already taking a look at this sort of rapid turnover, this millennialization of work where people don't have sort of the lifelong commitment to one job. So average number of jobs between ages 18 and 48, 11.7. That was pretty eye-opening for me. I didn't expect it to be that high. But take a look at the average spells of unemployment. If the average person during that range has 5.6, high school dropouts or graduates, you can see the numbers obviously there as well. College graduates, about 4 spells of unemployment. That number is expected to skyrocket in the new economy. How many of you guys in this room have had 4 spells of unemployment? Almost none. Well, you've got 4 to go, okay? So just keep that in mind. There is still time. Yes, retirement? It certainly would be unemployment, wouldn't it? Yeah. The point being, these are already not reflective of much of the society. So there are some people on the other end of that spectrum who are having far more periods of unemployment. And the expectation is that there will be a dramatic increase in the number of periods of unemployment in the new way that we work. That will bring with it uncertainty. It will bring with it this growing divide between who provides benefits and then the people who share those benefits. It will probably mean that there will be two types of workers, those that do have this rotating set of work and a much smaller number that have longer-term commitments to organizations. It will continue to put pressure on the very issue David mentioned earlier, that the distance between who is the owner-operator of an organization and who actually does the work that that owner-operator needs done is further and further apart. And as that distance grows, the visibility between that owner-operator and the needs of those workers, the health and safety challenges of those workers, gets more and more insulated. There could be no reason for an owner-operator to change their approach to health and safety if they never, ever have visibility six or seven subcontracts down as to the nature of the actual conditions of work. So that growing divide will continue to challenge those of us in the health and safety space. Here's a semi-autonomous truck in Nevada. The studies that are being done from a health and safety standpoint, dramatic conclusions, okay? Your, I think, risk of having an automobile accident is one accident in about 8 years of routine driving, okay? A semi-autonomous vehicle already, just to date, even with its really fairly new limited experience in technology, one accident in 80 human lifetimes. So there will be no reason not to move and adopt this technology very, very quickly. We also know something about, you can see the driver in this vehicle is looking at a tablet, so he's actually working on an iPad in this photo. But these workers already have reported much, much decreased levels of workplace stress and even worker fatigue and improved quality of sleep have all been reported in the drivers of semi-autonomous vehicles. So it's very likely that this kind of work will allow for 24 hours of driving at one point in the future, will allow for periods of sleep during operation of these vehicles. These are other changes that we're expecting to challenge the health and safety milieu that we find ourselves in. Obviously, NIOSH is still concerned about motor vehicle safety, so any technology that can lower the risk is of dramatic interest to us. Why? This is still the leading cause of workplace death. Anyone want to take a guess as to the percentage of workplace fatalities that are related to motor vehicles? That's a good guess. 40% is even better. It's 36%. And it is by far the greatest number of workplace deaths. It's the most common cause. But it's even more common than cause 2 and cause 3 combined. Anyone want to guess as what the second most fatal activity on the job is? Driving is first. Falls from height is number 2. Number 3, shocker for me, number 3. And I heard poisoning, I heard electrical violence. Workplace violence is the third leading cause of workplace death. But even combined, 2 and 3 do not equate to the number of people who die from motor vehicle-related accidents. And more than half are not in the transportation industry, right? So this is a real fatal workplace risk in every industry, and it has to be on your agenda. How your workers get to and from job to job or home to job or what their duties are on travel, very, very important and high risk. The only fatality at CDC in the modern day has been transportation related. So this is it's very real in government as well. We, again, are not going to talk about football, but I wanted to share this example because if, for those of you who read the sports page, there's a very good chance that a computer wrote the article you are reading. Sports journalism is highly, highly done in an automated fashion now. So a computer program can watch a game, can analyze the game, and write the article in a matter, it'll be ready for press in 2 to 3 minutes after the game is over. So sports writers, another dying profession. The human element here is in many ways becoming secondary to some of the technology changes that we are dealing with. And it isn't really only in the hardware and the computerization where work is shifting as well. There's a tremendous amount of re-engineering of the way people interact with their employer from a social perspective. We know that benefits design dramatically changing. If the Affordable Care Act goes away, what replaces it may even require further evolution in this space. LinkedIn is an example of one of the new, you know, fairly new high-tech startup companies, information, computer-based technology companies that have been experimenting with benefits design for quite some time. So maybe about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, they introduced a policy where employees could take unlimited vacation. Any of you have a policy of unlimited vacation? A couple people, amazing. In just a second, I want to ask you how it's gone. Just in case you're knowing or wondering, NIOSH does not have a policy of unlimited vacation, so don't think that we're there yet. LinkedIn, though, has reported within the first year almost no abuse of this program, increased satisfaction, no slowing in production, and however they might measure that. And it's widely lauded as a way that they recruit new talent. Has your own experience been positive as well in that new policy?
Yeah, I work a lot more.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, in fact, there's some people, he said, I work a lot more. And some people, we've heard that there is a bit of peer pressure and that it's really peer-controlled as to how much vacation people use. So it's quite interesting to see that it's not really only the hard technology that's evolving, but some of the social policies in the workplace are changing as well. I show this picture because I want to remind us that despite all of the changes that are happening, there's still a lot of work that's quite challenging. My guess is that this person is not interested in the noontime Tai Chi class, okay? So if you're thinking about ways to improve his health and well-being, that's probably not one of them. And I say that to draw attention back to the fact that workers have to be involved in any health decision we make, in any work-life decision we make, in the benefits design process, in the selection of PPE, in the root cause analysis. Workers are the most expert about what impacts their health and well-being. So one of the tenets of total worker health is if you don't have a participatory approach, whether it's on the safety side, the health promotion side, or anywhere in between, you're missing the boat because they're the ones most impacted by it. And if they have a role in the design and development of any solution, safety, health, benefit, otherwise, they're more likely to engage and support it. They're more likely to buy into it and follow it through. So the participatory approach, an extremely vital component of total worker health. Also a reminder of the number of jobs that still have very crippling, damaging, difficult working conditions. And I put this slide in to say these are not workplaces that are ready for total worker health solutions. These are workplaces that need improvement in the conditions of work. And if your organization is thinking about looking beyond just traditional safety and what more can I do to invest in the health and well-being of workers and send them home with more health at the end of the day, start by looking at the nature and conditions of work. You cannot overcome 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours of poor working conditions with a lunchtime lunch and learn on diabetes. It's not possible. The fastest, surest way to healthier workers is better working conditions. It gets back to the first two slides where we had 20 items that show how work and the conditions of work are linked to health outcomes. That science has been written. We do not need to debate whether or not there's an increased risk in shift work and cancer. That's been shown in a number of very high-quality studies. So what does that mean? We get rid of shift work? Not possible. Hospitals, police, firefighters. Shift work is an essential component of that type of work. So you can't get rid of it. But what you can do is turn up the frequency and intensity of interventions and other ways to help those workers. For shift workers on the night shift, guess how many health fairs are held at 2 a.m. We need to hold all our health fairs at 2 a.m. because those are the highest risk workers. Those are the workers who are more obese, they're more vulnerable, they're less experienced, they tend to have more injuries and illness, they tend to have more social disruption, more divorce, they have more fertility problems in women. The number of risks are not equivalent in all your workers. So in general, we tend to push programs that sort of edge into the non-work and enhance people's lives into the C-suite or the office of the director, we would call it, the corporate office setting. Those are the workers who are least likely in need of those considerations. So as you're looking at populations to intervene from a worker health standpoint, look at the most vulnerable and invest more there. Increase the frequency and the intensity in those workers who have the poorest working conditions, the most vulnerable populations that are there. And in general, you can pretty much say those are the lower wage workers, right? Lower wage, by its very definition, has a tremendous amount of risks related to it. A huge correlation between wage and longevity, between wage and health. So if you want a quick way to look at where our highest risks are, start by looking at the needs of your lowest paid workers. That's an extremely very quick way to think about moving people, to think about providing solutions for people at highest risk. Oh, one more thought here. I was just in New York City not long ago, and taxi drivers certainly have workplace violence risks. The average taxi driver in New York City spends as much time in their vehicle to drive from New York City to South Carolina every day. Imagine a job where you had to wake up every day and drive from New York City to South Carolina. That's the nature and conditions of their work. They're not driving that many miles, but they're in their vehicle for that long. It's pretty dramatic.
Is that 12 hours?
Their shifts are in sometimes 12 hours. Some of them, some local jurisdictions have decreased the number of hours, but in general, 12 hours is still typical. And that's what's required, but the enforcement in those hours is, you know, it's just not done. A reminder of some of the other challenges in low-wage work other than the ones that we've mentioned. Effort-reward imbalance. So in general, these jobs are hard. They're more physically demanding the lower the wage. And we expect, as I mentioned before, that divide between the highly skilled with a lot of opportunity for moving from a high-paid gig to gig and then that lower-paid worker who doesn't have those opportunities. That effort-reward imbalance, a huge cause of workplace stress. It's one of the leading ones. In you know, NIOSH has had a 30-year history looking at stress. It's only been in the last few that we've started to understand the connection between workplace stress, not as some amorphous, oh, it's everybody has workplace stress. Oh, a little bit of stress is good. We're talking about things that diminish people's length of their lives and the quality of lives that lead to early disability. Workplace stress is really real. It's not just, oh, everybody has a bad day. We know that there are correlations between disability, between injury and illness risk, and longevity itself. We've talked about job insecurity. The other issue is forced overtime. So people who don't have security about their next paycheck, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks down the road, are more likely to be willing to take advantage of overtime when it's available. And there are oftentimes conditions where people must take overtime or else someone else will be found to replace them. And that obviously has health impacts as well. We talk a lot at NIOSH about aging of the workforce. In truth, the most rapidly growing part of the workforce, even in your own companies, is those workers over age 65. They're even now, that may even be being rivaled by the rate of change in workers over age 75. CDC had a scientist, really the modern father of cholesterol testing, who worked until his 94th birthday. So it's not uncommon for people to be in the workforce in the 10th or so decade of life. But for us, aging is really just a reminder that improving working conditions for people who are old helps everybody else, right? The same needs that older workers have, really every single generation and age of workers, every decade of workers could benefit from. So better lighting, better noise control, better ergonomics, better attention to a match between skill set and job, better attention to ergonomics and job design, the human factors that really basically industrial hygiene is all about. Those are benefits for everyone, not only for older workers. One of our concerns, though, from an aging and work standpoint, is that the quality of jobs that older workers are taking now is far more diminished than ever before. So it's oftentimes older workers who must stay in the workforce, who feel a need to, are being forced into poor quality jobs. And that's a trend that is fairly new and we expect to continue. There's also new science that I wanted to share with you about the connection between work and health from a chronic disease standpoint. And we've oftentimes started to get to some of the risk factors related to that, but we really haven't understood the lifelong consequences of that. And this is data from the REGARD study. It's funded by NIH and NIOSH, and these are some Bureau of Labor Statistics that are brought into that. And it looked at the occupations with the worst risk factors for stroke or for heart disease, including high blood pressure, body mass index, cholesterol, blood sugar, physical activity, smoking, and nutrition. And you can see on the left the most challenged occupations. Police and firefighters have the worst cardiovascular risk scores. Now, for those of you in that industry, it's no surprise to you, my guess is. In fact, the leading cause of death in firefighters is not fall from a building or being crushed by a burning building, it's cardiovascular. That's how they die. And the firefighter fatality investigation program that's done at NIOSH has done a lot to uncover these connections between the conditions of work, including shift work, and some of these metrics and outcomes. And service occupations, second. So again, wage coming into effect there, my guess is time, poverty, some of the other social determinants of health that are showing up as risk factors related to that job. And on the other side, you can see some of the most healthiest job professions based on these cardiovascular risk metrics. Now, these metrics are important because more than half of us in this room will die of cardiovascular risk, right? So this is a very important component. We know that there are other real connections. Here's study results that have been shown that shift working men are less likely to eat vegetables and fruits. Shift working women get more energy intake from saturated fat. Here's a study done in one of our own total worker health centers that looks at the relationship between worker stressors and obesity. And basically, you can see a linear relationship. If you have more stresses, and they're listed below, things like low decision latitude, physical assault at work in the past 3 months, heavy lifting, so these are not just experiences, but they're actually conditions of work. If you have five of those conditions, you're four times more likely to be obese than a coworker who doesn't have them. So we know there are lifelong implications that connect conditions of work and some of these lifestyle risk factors. Smoking interventions, another important one. We know that some professions really predict your rate of tobacco use. Anybody want to guess what where we see the highest rates of tobacco use? Which professions? Construction, certainly up there. In general, mining and construction are two of the highest. Outdoor jobs, where there are not restrictions, there tend to be higher rates of smokers. So outdoor jobs. We at NIOSH have strong push for tobacco-free workplaces because every place indoor smoking is allowed is someone's workplace, right? There is not a place where smoking is allowed that isn't a place where someone doesn't have the right to not enter that space. So every indoor smoking place allowed is someone's workplace where they may have many, many hours of secondhand exposure, not just very intermittent exposure risk. So we really strongly advocate for tobacco-free policies. The point of this slide, though, is that if you want people to stop smoking, you've got to look at more than just their tobacco habit. You have to look at the conditions of work that may be driving that. You have to look at what are the challenges of overcoming this, given the nature of their work, and think more holistically about intervening. And this study really looked at how one intervention increased wages and the number of smokers went down in that study. Now, it's an interesting. Higher rates of unionization also led to decreased tobacco. It's an interesting take. So as we talk about the challenges of the 21st century, we need to really look at solutions. And that's one of the reasons that NIOSH is investing in this concept of total worker health. Because we need to have a research program that's agile, that takes this comprehensive view, this cumulative risk view, as it relates to worker health. Obviously, we don't have a program without this. This is the foundation of NIOSH. It's what we're required to do under the OSHA Act. All of the work that we do has to support this mission. We say, though, there's more value in going above and beyond that for companies who can. And we think that that value not only translates into better performance in the stock market, there's some very good studies that show that, but also better for workers and better for those workers coming back to work the next day. So what are those companies that are ready to take the next step do? It really comes down to our three P's. Look at the policies, practices, and programs that you can provide your workers. And we're really much interested in the organizational interventions. We don't talk a lot about behavior change programs, smoking cessation programs, fitness centers, diabetes education. Those are important, but they're not enough. That's just not going to move the needle on the dial because it's the 8, 10, 12 hours a day of workplace exposures that's driving many of these outcomes, not someone's lack of knowledge that smoking is bad for them. Most people know that. So we really focus interventions on conditions and quality of work and how they impact health, the first 20 items in the first two slides. And this is the metric that we've chosen as our measure that we're going to be pushing toward improving in our research program. And in order to do that, we've developed a tool that we're actually looking for companies to help us test. So if you think your company is really interested in this very comprehensive approach to improving the health of the workforce, we'd be interested in hearing from you. This metric that we've developed will be, it's an OMB clearance now, so it's sort of in the Paperwork Reduction Act process of the government development of survey and research instruments, and soon we'll be looking for people to pilot it with. So we'd love to hear from you if that's the case. I've already talked to you about the companies that send their workers home at the end of the day with more health. In one sentence, that's really the goal of the Total Worker Health Program. Send your workers home healthier than when they got there that morning. Here's our formal definition. It's about 40 words, so I just really like the previous slide a little bit better. Basically, it comes down to protecting people from work-related safety and health hazards and then promoting injury and illness from a very broad perspective. The OSHA Act that Dave mentioned this morning has a clause that a lot of people don't oftentimes remember. So it's to provide safe and healthful working conditions, workplaces. But the rest of the OSHA Act says, and to preserve our human resources. And that really is the mandate that we're using for this program. We also believe there's a lot of value in integrating programs. My guess is that there are occupational health folks in the room and safety folks in the room from the same company that rarely interact. We think that's a lost opportunity. So there is some value in integrating programs in your organization. So HR, benefits, employee assistance, safety, occupational health, sustainability, risk control, all of those really at the end of the day have very tightly aligned metrics. And the more they integrate programs, we see a lot of value in that effort. Here's a good example of a total worker health approach for musculoskeletal conditions. First, look at what changes need to be made in the work, then go to ergonomics, and then go to the level of the individual. We know that arthritis is a huge driver for musculoskeletal injury. People behave differently when they're in chronic pain. They lift differently if they have underlying health conditions. But we start with looking at nature and conditions of work first, then drilling down to what are the ergonomics and human factors of this job, and then we finally would move to what are the individual level interventions, knowing that each has a place, but we prioritize the intervention. This is sort of the hallmark study that launched the Total Worker Health Research Program, and it was done at Harvard by Dr. Gloria Sorensen, and it basically said that if you wanted to help people quit smoking, you could do that, and your average success rate was about 6%. But when she did that, matched with a safety intervention and integrated the two together, her quit rate doubled. And we're like, how did that happen? What was the impetus for those changes? How is that actually occurring? So it turns out, and this is her hypothesis, that if you show people you care about their well-being at work, they're more likely to listen to you when it comes to the rest of their health. Why am I going to listen to this person about diabetes when obviously they don't care if I die on the job today based on these working conditions? So this really led to a more formal exploration of this integration of safety training, safety interventions with this broader cumulative risk total worker health approach. And she's done a number of interventions in addition to this one that have shown very similar findings. Here are a list of all the issues where we have ongoing research. And you can see it really runs the gamut of traditional hazards all the way down to policy and benefits changes. And a lot of now new research that's being funded within NIOSH and through our centers on this sort of new employment arrangements. How is that going to impact health and safety? What interventions should we be doing in this new type of working arrangement? What are the demographic challenges that we need to overcome? Here are examples of some total worker health policies, programs, and practices, the three Ps that I mentioned. So I invite you to take a look at those as you think about where your own organization might move into these areas. I think I've already made the point that we're really not a traditional wellness program. We think that wellness has a significant role to play in organizations, but it should not be a starting point for most companies. It should be something that's really at the end of a set of interventions. And a wellness program, even if it's hero quality, 5-star, will not overcome hazardous conditions of work. It will not overcome high levels of workplace stress, high levels of demand, poor working conditions. It's just not enough. It's not adequate. You have to really get to the very nature of work itself to try to impact health at the end of the day. Traditional workplace hazards still threaten many workers. The most direct path to better health is safer work. We have these four fundamentals that we really try to push in all of the interventions that we create around total worker health. And obviously, first dollar investment has to be safety in our programming. If you do integrate relevant systems, like people's occupational medicine, into the nature of their work, there have to be adequate privacy protections built in. We really also focus on long-term culture building as opposed to sort of, you know, the quick 3-month biggest loser contest or something like that. We think really we're talking about generational change here if we really want to take a public health approach to improving the quality of jobs and to translate that into better health for workers. It really is about changing the culture in organizations and really in the country as a whole. And then lastly, making sure that we have that participatory model, that people do actually have a stake in the creation of these programs because they're far more likely to succeed. We've already talked about how work is changing, and there really has been this major shift from stability in employment to what many people call precariousness, or whether or not you're likely to have a job. And there are a number of reasons behind this. But in general, the model that most of us have lived through is in trouble, and it is changing. The fact that people now live regularly into their 90s and certainly into their 80s, but retirement is, in the 60s, that's got to change. I mean, that's not really a sustainable model. So it'll be interesting to see how some of these new social programs in Northern Europe work, where people are paid not to work or paid, everybody's given an allowance, if you will, for the basic needs of life, and only a certain portion of people actually work above that. So this will be an interesting sort of trial to see how that actually works out. The 21st century work characteristics, though, are really what I'm most interested in, and where I think we will have the most opportunity to influence health by changing the nature of work. And some of the things that we've seen as difficult, like adjusting to all the technological changes, they could very well be part of the solution. They could very well help us get over some of these challenges. I mean, you have in the palm of your hand far more access to information than, people could even imagine just, a generation ago. So that access, that really equalizing of access to information could very well be part of the solution for some of the challenges that we're facing. These new employment patterns, though, much of our research really looks at some of the safety risks that are arising from those work arrangements. And this is where we are really quite concerned that that as work organization changes, as demands in workplaces changes, there is intensification of work, there is this downsizing mandatory over time, and obviously stressors increasing from the nature of these work arrangements as well. What about the health effects? We talked some already about stress. The disconnect, though, between work and benefits, though, which was certainly a move that was afoot under the Affordable Care Act. As I said, we really don't know what will happen post the Affordable Care Act. But that's going to be an area where we have to watch very closely, because health benefits and access to health care is another very strong predictor of health. It's not as strong as wage, but it is a very strong predictor of health outcomes. So where workers, where people in general get their health benefits is going to be a dramatic influence on health overall. Here's the other question that NIOSH is very interested in, and John Howard probably speaks on this topic publicly more than any other. Are contingent workers, as protected by government safety and health regulatory enforcement, as are non-contingent workers? Again, this growing divide between the people who own and operate industries and those who actually do the work many, many levels and layers down. This is a quick look at really a comparison of access to paid leave and other supports in U.S. jobs. And I think probably the most important column to look at is the third one over. So these are people in the lowest paid jobs, and I want you to compare them to the full-time jobs, which is the fifth column over. And you can basically see they do far better in general in things like paid leave, short-term disability benefits, vacation, sick leave, the flexibility of their work. So very much wages and whether or not a job is full-time or part-time is impacting many of these job supports. And certainly, clearly, we've shown health impacts of all of these types of benefits. So just really further proof that policies in the workplace have significant health effects. Some of our research is looking at these issues. We know that new economy jobs are more hazardous than standard jobs, partly because of this disconnect between who's responsible and the work being done. There oftentimes is limited training or limited availability and use of personal protective equipment in these settings. Oftentimes, these workers are less likely to report unsafe conditions because of worries about the next job and confusion about who is responsible. Here's another major challenge that workers have faced in the past decade. This is about as flat as you can get, and wages have been exactly that flat. And some of you probably have experienced this in your own set, but if you look at wages, and this really is data up through 2014, after adjustment for inflation, the median wages have been stagnant between 2000 and 2014. So in this kind of setting, and partly that is technology driving that, partly it is some of the downsizing, partly it is mechanization, partly it is just the overall economy. You can see there's been variation in between, but even the extremes, this is 328 to 348, so it's been a very narrow window. Wages in general have been very flat, and that has also impacted worker health. There's no doubt about that, because wage and health extremely highly correlated. At the same time, though, the percent changes in work stress, especially according to some of these different work arrangements, has changed dramatically. Look at the percentage change in work stress from 2002 to 2014. If you were paid by a temporary agency, you report a 48% increase in your perceived level of workplace stress. Now, compare that to the work under a contract or an independent contractor who have far dramatically lower. Now, you think, well, contracts, isn't that sort of similar? Is some uncertainty there? In general, these are the small business owners, the small business owner operators who have a tremendous amount of control over their workplace. And that's really the secret, to diminish workplace stress, giving people more control, more decision-making authority, bringing it down to their level to make decisions about where, when, how the work is done, shows you what an antidote to a high-stress work environment you can actually see. This, by far, is the number one reason that NIOSH gets consulted in the Total Worker Health Program, is we have a high level of stress in our organization and we want to know what to do about it. So instead of moving just to EAP or to programs that build resiliency, we ask those companies to take a look at the nature and conditions of work first. And then ask their employees, what are your biggest causes of stress? In general, they point back to organizational factors, not individual factors. They point back to poor supervisory relationships, to unreasonable expectations, to challenges around wages. Those tend to be where a lot of these things are arising. And then we help organizations develop a plan to tackle those from an organizational to an individual approach. So it really doesn't matter what kind of boss you have. Some people would say all work has its level of stress. We actually have done quite a bit of research in this concept of healthier supervision. And we've done a number of workshops with companies around really how can you train people who manage your people to better understand that their behavior, their choice-making, their the way they structure the nature of the job has a tremendous impact on health. And you can see a number of metrics here that really bear that out. There's a strong correlation between how people manage and the health of their workforce. So our workshop really focused on what are the skills that people need, that managers need, supervisors need, to actually influence the health of their workers. What skill set do they need? What knowledge do they need? And largely it comes down to better people skills. So better softer skills. More appropriate recognition of people in trouble. More appropriate reward setting. More socialization among workers was a huge way to decrease stress and to have better self-reports of greater continuity, greater enjoyment of the work experience. So we know that the benefits of healthier supervision from an employee engagement standpoint, getting people involved and engaged in their work, dramatically different between those that were and those that weren't, and based on the quality of supervision. So an extremely important connection. Quality of leadership had the strongest relationship with engagement and motivation of employment. So we think there's more that can be done in the way we manage and train the next generation of supervisors and leaders in this regard. A couple examples from the private sector of workplace flexibility programs and how they increase productivity and decrease turnover. So flexibility, as I mentioned, a very powerful antidote to high levels of workplace stress. We also have to remember that every worker, really, despite whether they have kids or not, despite whether they have family issues, every worker does struggle to integrate work and life changes. So attention to these issues, very, very important too if we want to optimize health outcomes. It's a very important approach. I mentioned a new cross-sector at NIOSH on healthy work design and well-being. You will be hearing more about that as the third decade of the National Occupational Research Agenda is released by NIOSH. That will be happening very soon. And there are councils being formed right now. So if this is a strong area of interest for you, and you would like to be involved in the development of this new area of research, it's another opportunity for you to let me know that you have an interest in that. I'm going to close just with a couple slides on the hierarchy of controls. This is the one that is the bread and butter of every occupational safety and health official, so nothing new here. We mapped the Total Worker Health Program to the hierarchy of controls and made our own. And this really basically follows that same paradigm of eliminating risks where you can, substituting better programs, policies, and practices if you can't eliminate all risks. Redesign. So this is the engineering part of recrafting jobs with health outcomes in mind. Moving to the individual level of educating, the administrative part, and then finally encouraging personal behavior change as an important but probably not nearly as effective in actually creating better health than some of the things higher up on the chain.
Wow. What'd you think? I told you, Casey's amazing. See, you're going to fall in love with him too. He's genuine, he's generous, and he's super smart. And I really, really like the way he represents what the CDC's doing. And the way he's thinking about work, safety, work life, work environment. It's all coming together. These lines that used to divide all this stuff are becoming fuzzier, fuzzier, and fuzzier. And I think Casey kind of illustrates that for us. It's a pretty good podcast. If you made it through, I bet you did too. Because this is the kind of thing, when I listen to him, I just kind of stop everything. And time kind of stops and everything moves pretty fast. And that's kind of what happened here. So that's the podcast. Hey, thanks for listening. I cannot do it without you. You are the best. I hope you get what you need, man. I want everyone to get what they need, especially now that it's kind of springy and nice and, I don't know, fun. Until then, Learn something new every single day. I know you did today, without a doubt. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes, be safe.